where does a lot of that earmark money end up anyway? You guys have heard some of the examples of where those dollars go. You've heard about the bridges, and you've heard about some of these pet projects that really don't make a whole lot of sense. And sometimes these dollars, they go to projects having little or nothing to do with the public good. Things like fruit fly research in Paris, France. I kid you not.
Terry?
Hi. Oh, yeah, this is Terry, and that's HK.
Me. So what are we doing?
So we are scientists, and we're going to talk about science things and non-science things in the news.
Yeah, we'll just talk about whatever we feel like talking about.
Yeah.
Sounds like a good idea. Hey, so by the way, I just pulled my groin.
Really? Were you playing football? Like football?
No,
football?
I was just walking. Like, you know, exercise walking. I don't know. It's like, you know, when you get to a certain age, right? And the worst thing is that it takes forever to recover. Like, this is going to go on for like 6 months now, right?
Yeah, because it's just like a pulled muscle.
Yeah, but it just don't recover like you used to.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, if you look at a kid when they get a cut, like a week later, it's entirely healed over. There's no scab or whatever. They have these magical healing powers. But for us, this tiniest thing takes forever.
Yeah, it's still bleeding.
Yeah. So, well, yesterday I just ran my fastest 5K ever.
Really?
Yeah, maybe one of my only 5Ks that I've run, but yeah.
Are you training?
Well, I'm trying to get exercise.
But, I mean, are you training for something?
No, not at all. Well, I'm training to, like, you know, be more fit and healthy and not, you know, be...
But you do a better job if you
have a plan.
Have a plan.
So my mission... Okay, so in 15 years from now, I'll run the marathon.
All right.
So you're telling me, so your friends' kids have lice? Has it
my friends' kids have lice, and, you know, my wife just, of course, freaks. So she's been checking the kids every day. They're fine. My kids are fine. But, yeah, what's the deal with lice, Terry?
Oh, because I'm an entomologist.
You're an entomologist, sorry.
Yeah.
So Terry is our green person, our, you know, ecologist. And I guess I'm the... cell molecular type.
Yeah. So there's lice, and it's interesting to me that, so since lice apparently, as far as I know, are not disease vectors, then they're not like this huge economic importance. So it's not like the U.S. government is spending money on research on controlling lice. And so you put insecticides in people's hair to kill them off. And so the same kind of insecticide that you can use in organic crops, like these permethrins, these pyrethroids, which are derived from chrysanthemum flowers. So you can use pesticides in organic crops. You can also put it like in your kid's hair when they have lice, and it kills off the insects. But the thing is, the lice are evolving resistance to these. So sometimes, depending on where you are, what lice strain you get, those shampoos don't kill them off nearly as well as they did.
So what are these? They're like, they're just what, metabolic blockers or something? What do they do? Do you know?
Okay, so I don't know. Talk to the cell molecular biologist who wants to know the mechanism.
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know how they kill off the insects. And so sometimes, like the way in which pesticides work really, really vary in that they block some particular metabolic pathway, or they prevent nutrients from being absorbed or change osmoregulation. I don't know how they kill insects, but they only act on feeding individuals. So if there's eggs or non-adults that are in someone's hair, then they're not going to be killed off as much.
So, okay. The other is it true that African Americans are less susceptible to lice?
Yeah, totally. Right? Well,
that's actually true.
Yeah, it is. So I think I've heard what's that, like, just black people don't get lice,
yeah.
And that's actually not true. But The lice that are prevalent all throughout North America were brought here by Europeans, you know, who had this thing where obviously, you know, we brought all these diseases. We, not meaning you, but, you know, the Europeans. And so the lice basically evolved to specialize on Europeans and European hair. And African-Americans, that is, people of African ancestry in America, are less likely to get these European lice because their hair is different. So if you take a cross-section of European hair, it's round. And I think that's true for Asian and other places. But apparently African hair, and this might have something to do with curliness, I don't know, but it's more oval in cross-section. And so the lice themselves, who cling to the base of the hair, they use their six legs and grasp it. The hair is shaped in a way that they basically can't hang on as well.
So the actual – if the length of the hair, so it's not cylindrical. It's sort of oval. The cross section isn't circular. You see, right?
Yeah.
So that's that's got something to do with the hair curling.
I think. I don't know about the curliness of the hair, because I don't know if people who have curly hair who aren't African, if they also have more oval hair. I don't know. I mean,
well, can you curl your hair to avoid it?
No, because it's the hair itself.
Strand. The shape. It's a strand.
Yeah.
Right?
It's a strand. Right. Yeah. So I think it's something like 10% of all kids or people in the U.S. end up getting lice at some point in their life. It's actually hit my family twice. Right. That's when I shaved my head. Last time when I shaved my head, like 4 or 5 years ago or whatever, that was because we had lice.
Wow, really?
And it was just a lot easier to shave my head than have to deal with it. Because I already had to help out the rest of my family, right? And so I don't have much hair anyway. It was just as well.
I thought you were being ironic for a minute there.
No, no.
Okay, you really did? Okay.
No, I really did. That's why I shaved my head. That was why. It was just easier. And so for African-Americans, it's less than 1% end up getting lice. I think there is a different species of lice in Africa, which is established – so Africans get lice, but it's a different species that is specialized on that hair. But basically, they never made the – biogeographically, they never made the trip over. So I don't know about the – you know, maybe if there's more – you know, an increase in global trade, maybe they'd end up getting established here. But, you know, if you look at the – you know, the way that, you know, diseases and epidemics and things flow, sometimes you need to sort of have a critical – mass, like you might have it being introduced once in a while, but unless, you know, it's in a community where it can spread really well.
I know, you know, with the whole bed bugs situation where there's now, it's coming back, I guess mostly from the lack of use of DDT or what have you, I'm not sure exactly. But is there also a increase in lice infestation?
I'm not sure. I don't know if there were DDT shampoos, but I know that there is a pyrethrin resistance. But I think so the bed bug thing, also they're evolving some resistance as well. I think, I don't know what the role is about. Well, clearly if we could just use DDT, we'd be killing off the bed bugs a lot more.
But I mean, bed bugs are on the rise.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think they're just getting harder to control, and I don't know why they're emerging. And the same thing with bed bugs is like with lice is that there are people I know who work on bed bugs, and they have a hard time getting funding because the U.S. Department of Agriculture doesn't want to pay for it because it's not an agricultural pest. The NIH doesn't want to pay for it because it's not a medical problem. National Science Foundation doesn't want to fund it because it's too applied. Environmental Protection Agency doesn't want to fund it because it basically doesn't affect environmental health in any way, really. And so basically the only funding is from industry. But then again, industry doesn't want to fund researchers who will like magically cure the problem because then they'd be out of all the money they'd be having paying for people to control it.
It's a cross-disciplinary problem.
It's like a gap. No one wants – all the people who want it to be fixed are the ones who aren't funding it, right?
About Center for Disease Control. It's not really a disease.
Right. That's the problem. Yeah, exactly. It's basically all they are is a massive annoyance. But they're not really, since they're not spreading any diseases, then there's no real financial incentive. Like, you know, basically, I'm sure there's plenty of, you know, capitalists out there will say, oh, well, the free market should fix this problem. If there's money for a cure, since there is, then some entrepreneur will find that.
It may not be a disease, but it's certainly it's a huge annoyance, and it's getting worse.
Right. So I guess as it gets worse, then I suppose then maybe better control methods will be developed by someone who's ready to profit off of it. But as you know, other insecticides aren't working as well. Where now it often takes multiple treatments and local control. Yeah, it's not good. Okay, so other news item I wanted to mention, if you haven't noticed. So there is the Homo naledi is a brand new human species that was discovered. And so it's a few hundred thousand years ago, apparently, they were buried in this cave in South Africa. And so it's a really cool story. And so there's two things about this that make the science, I think, interesting and different compared to other human fossil discoveries. I think the story of what we're learning about human evolution is cool, but I want to talk about that. So the two things I wanted to mention is, first of all, I just think it's really awesome that when they published this paper, they also published online the plans for all of the bones of this fossil. You can download those and 3D print them. So today, I bet in schools all around the country, teachers printed out these bones and they're working on them, you know, with the kids in their classroom, you know, from this brand new discovery.
So what do you mean by plans? So what are you downloading? Just the pictures?
Well, I don't know. No, I mean, it's like the digital file that you feed to the 3D printer to print a copy of the bone.
So these are 3D image, 3D files.
Right, yeah. So 3D printing. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So I thought it was really cool, like when my dentist 3D printed my new tooth, you know, in the course of half an hour. That was really awesome. But I mean, just to see that, like, oh, here's a brand new fossil, and the scientists are literally sharing the 3D image of this fossil with the whole world with precise detail. And apparently any standard 3D printer can handle it.
Wow. So they can take these and then sort of try to put them together themselves. I mean, they can kind of follow what the scientists are doing.
Right. And if someone disagrees with what the scientists are doing, then they can have their own copies and work on them. Now, apparently this discovery happened more than a year ago, and it took them a whole time to work this up. It's not as like they, you know, made them available to the world as soon as they were found. But as soon as the first paper came out, which was not in a fancy prestige journal, it was just eLife, which is, you know, Nature or Science, I'm sure, would be publishing this. But they decided to publish in an open access journal instead.
Is this a consortium or is it a particular research group?
Yeah, I don't know about it. I don't know in grand detail about who the investigators are. The two good articles I read about this were in the Atlantic and the National Geographic. Oh, that's something else we need to talk about.
Publications. Was Johansson involved? He's the only name I know.
No. I don't think so. Okay. The one person I know of that was involved is John Hawks. I just know him because he has a really good blog.
Is he the Australian guy? No?
He is somewhere in the U.S., I believe.
Okay, maybe I'm making
yeah. Anyway, and so, so the other thing about this fossil discovery story that I think is interesting, or at least entertaining, is it was found in this cave, like outrageously deep in the side of some hill. And so you had to be like a hardcore caver to get there, and you had to go through this region that they call like the Superman gap or the Superman floor, where basically it was 11 inches high. So they called it the Superman because the only way you could squirm your way through is putting one arm to your side and one arm in front of you and squeezing your way through this gap that was several feet long. And then over this hill and down this other chute, but there was someone basically got far enough to this one point where they took a picture at a distance and they saw a couple bones that were clearly hominid remains. They thought it was an Australopithecus or something, which is kind of exceptional because you wouldn't be expecting necessarily to find these kinds of fossils in South Africa as much as some other regions. Not to say that people weren't there, but normally that's not where people have been prospecting for fossils. And so the investigator in 2013, just a couple of years ago, put an ad on Facebook saying, I'm looking for someone who's a skilled caver, hopefully a climber, who is really skinny and has field science skills. And he thought, oh, there might be a few people in the world who might be interested. And it turned out he got like 60 or so applications from people, all of whom were qualified. And so it was a team of six women who went in to do this. So the investigator that, you know, imagined this project actually physically himself could not access this space, but it was these six skinny women. And that's how they've been characterized as skinny, and people have issues with how they're characterized. But clearly, you've got to be skinny to fit through that space to access and do the field work. And so it's just interesting to me that, like, you know, someone saw an ad on Facebook, okay, I'm trying to hire you to go do this fossil dig, and you have to be, you know, skinny and a caver and have field science skills. And bam, and these are amazing, you know, women who did a lot of the serious science in getting the project done.
So did he say they have to be really skinny?
Yeah, so I don't know what the responses were to that ad, but clearly, you know, if it's saying, oh, I'm looking for someone who's a caver and skinny, then people can read between the lines.
You know, yeah, I bet it worked.
A person my size clearly would not be applying for that job, and I shouldn't be upset for not being qualified.
Well, that's great. Was it just a single fossil? Just the one?
I think there were some other remains in that area, but there was this one very, very complete skeleton.
So is this a thing where they did try to figure out how it got there? Like, what is this? Like a burial ground?
Yeah. And so the storyline is that they're, well, depending on how you interpret it, that they actually were buried there, that it was like some form of ritual burial. But then anthropologists are saying, well, it depends on what you call burial and what you call ritual. But yeah, clearly it looks like they were somehow placed there.
So this was, you said this discovery was made like a while back, right? I mean, a year ago, what was it you just said?
Well, I think it was in 2013 when the ad was placed for the field work to happen.
So, but why is it a big deal now? What's with the news now?
I mean, so the paper just got published and now the whole world knows. Then there was like a media embargo on it. Okay. So this, the big discovery was just announced.
Okay. The paper just got published. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And the 3D plans for all the bones. So I thought that was a cool story.
I got to look at the pictures. Do you have pretty pictures of this? Do you have nice pictures of this?
They are good pictures. They're good pictures of the outline. Yeah, yeah.
Check that out.
So, I mean, they're bones.
Yeah.
It looks like human bones. But it was really also, it fits into a weird place in the human phylogeny where it's like, wait, this is clearly a human, but, you know, it basically opens up a lot more questions and answers, like, you know, most good discoveries.
How old is it?
Hundreds of thousands of years old. But it's one of our closest ancestors. I mean, it's in the genus Homo, clearly, you know, because there's also other human species like, you know, Australopithecus, for example.
Right.
So
maybe we can put a link up on the show notes.
Yeah, so on the show notes on the website, notjustscientist.com, we'll have a link to the cool relevant stories to that, including a picture of the path that you would have to take to get through the tunnel to access them. There's a cool graphic representing all the work they had to do.
Any videos of that? No videos.
I haven't seen the videos. I don't know. I'm sure there are some.
I'm sure there must be, right?
Yeah. But that's probably going to be some special on Fox News, National Geographic.
Maybe not Fox News.
Fox Science Network.
By the way, did you hear that? Did you hear that Rupert Murdoch just bought National Geographic?
Yeah, that's what I was. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's horrible. It ruined my day or my month or.
God.
I had
sitting. Why would he buy that? Just to ruin it?
Well, I think he's trying. I mean, the general vague, you know, gut response is, well, he's just trying to rule the world and, you know, control media and information as much as possible. And so, I mean, it's just another avenue of controlling information. I mean, but I think other people would say then, well, he's just trying to make money, right? And so it's like, and it's it basically got it on a bargain.
You know, if there's one person when he dies who's going to leave the world in a worse place than when he found it, it's Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah. Sam Walton.
Sam Walton.
Sam Walton I'd put up in there. The Walmart guy.
Yeah.
So, so the National Geographic thing. So apparently what happened, as far as I know, is that the magazine hasn't been doing as well. The society's finances have been on the brink. And so, because National Geographic Society is a nonprofit that does more than just the movie and the cable channel, but, you know, they have an archive and a museum, and they fund research. And
yes,
so actually,
right.
And so actually I got a National Geographic grant to do some work in the outback in Australia like 8 years ago. And so these National Geographic, so you could look at what they did was they gave a bunch of money to the society to purchase the rights to the TV and the magazine. So now those are owned and run by Rupert Murdoch. So he doesn't own the society, and the society just basically got a huge endowment. So they basically sold off the valuable stuff, the media products, so that they could continue to exist.
So it's the society that funds the research then?
Right. Yeah, there's a committee for research and exploration, I believe it's called. And so you apply to, and so there's awards for students, and there's awards for, you know, more established investigators. And so it's basically $20,000 a pop you can apply for are the grants that they fund. And basically they're just looking for any kind of research that explores new places, finds new things, that explains the world better.
Fair enough. But my argument is, If they're selling off all their precious stuff, the magazine, the TV rights, in order to save the society, what exactly are they saving? Are they saving their ability to fund research? I mean, I can't believe Rupert Murdoch's not gonna put his hands in that, right? What's the justification for selling the stuff off?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the justification is to keep the society afloat because they were running out of money. And so, I mean, so I'm not saying it's wise. And indeed, so the analogy I see it as, it's like a library selling all their books so they can keep the lights on and pay their power bill. So you'll have a library, but you don't have any books. And so what's National
Geographic? You don't have a library then, right? So now, yeah, right. What is society? Now it doesn't exist. I mean, it's bizarre. Right. I don't get it, but anyway.
Yeah, no, it's problematic to say the least. I think some people say, well, it's been long in coming. So just to be clear, why is this a problem? It's like he is basically an avowed climate denier. Like he doesn't, you know, think that anthropogenic climate change is a real thing.
Well, great. Now he owns the National Geographic.
So, yeah. So we don't know how much he'll be pushing the scales on the content. I mean, people are saying the TV channel has been sliding anyway. And there's mixed opinions about the magazine, although I think it's solid. But
it also shows you kind of the fearsomeness of institutions. Like I remember, like I don't want to name names, but I was part of this organization that was just starting up, that was supposed to help scientists do certain things. And so it was a small group of people, and they were all interested in what can we do? Can we do this? Can we do that? So the mission was to help scientists do a certain specific thing. But after a while, I mean, the organization just became an organization where it's about how do we stay alive? It's about feeding the beast, right? So the raison d'etre stopped being about helping scientists do things. It became about how do you get the scientists to keep this thing afloat, right?
Yeah, I mean, so I understand that as times change, your mission needs to evolve. But if the mission is to continue to exist,
exactly,
then you're no longer serving that. Then you've entirely lost your goal.
It stops being an organization and it starts becoming an organism.
Right, and so I think a lot of small nonprofits clearly fall into that gap where they have this initial flurry. Oh, we're doing this, but then all of a sudden you have people on the payroll and you're getting a job done and you're not pulling in money, and so then you'll do what you can to get by and. Sometimes it doesn't meet what the goal is, and it just becomes a business or a source of employment rather than a grander goal.
I'm sure there's a whole body of research into this stuff, right? I would think.
I don't know. But a bunch of nonprofits I've been involved with or seen or, you know, known people who have worked for close to me, you know, this has come up.
Yeah. It's frustrating. So, sure.
Yeah. So I'm sure the people working working for National Geographic probably are relieved because they're probably not going to get fired unless they're working on the magazine and they're pushing for some kinds of content over other content. But just the people just pushing the books on a day-to-day basis, you know, this is good news for them.
Yeah, at least in the short term.
Yeah, I mean, but then again, if they're working there to try to support the grand mission, then maybe, you know, it's like being able to feed your family is one thing. But if you choose a job in the nonprofit sector, that's probably because you want to work to fulfill the mission of that organization to some extent, because it pays less. So that's why you'd be doing it.
Well, best of luck to them.
Yeah.
God help us.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, I'm not helping him out because I've had my renewal notice sitting in my house. And then I was like, oh, and so instead of filling it out, I just put it in the recycling bin. So,
well, he lost one reader.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see like what gets funded now.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there'll be any massive reversal immediately, but I think. But might they be just subtly trying? I mean, because, you know, he's subtle enough to be able to, you know, if there's a massive change, then there would be a huge revolt. But if you just taint the well just by adding a little bit of poison slowly.
Which is, I think, what he's doing, what he did to the Wall Street Journal, right? I don't really read the journal much, but at one point it was an honest newspaper. I know the editorial section has always been crazy, but you know, it was a real serious national newspaper. But I think it's, as you say, it's still serious, but it's just got that little edge to it, little poison.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I've heard. I mean, so also people might be more inclined to think it's that way just because of the ownership. And so I know there are some disgruntled people from the Wall Street Journal that have said, oh, this is how, while the editorial page has always been crazy, there's been serious news item. But now what's being covered, what's not being covered is more being prescribed from above in a way that didn't used to happen. But then again, I know some people who read the Wall Street Journal who are moderate but businessy, and they're like, yeah, it's still fine. It's okay. That hasn't changed a lot.
Yeah, but I think it's probably going to be more about what's, you know, it's a sin of omission, right?
Right.
It's like what doesn't get put into the newspaper.
Yeah. And so one thing, actually, this is the other thing I wanted to talk about what's not in the paper, is I was annoyed. So I get
paper are we talking about now?
Well, now I'm talking about the LA Times.
LA
Times. The paper. Because okay. I get the LA Times print at home. Like, go out in the morning, you know, pull in the paper, you know, make my coffee. And then I read the paper, read the funnies, read other stuff. And so, but at first I'd already looked at social media and saw that news was everywhere. Everyone was excited about this new human fossil. So I was reading about this on my phone, pulling out the paper, saying, oh, I'm going to read about it in the paper because that's a lot more pleasant. And there was nothing, zip, zilch, nada about this basically the science find of the week or the month or arguably the year. And there was nothing about it at all in the LA Times. And so there was clearly a press embargo and it was launching yesterday, but there was nothing in there, so they basically decided not to cover it. And I was like, what the, did they miss a deadline, what? So then I looked at the LA Times website, and then they did have a cover and it was on the front page, but it was like an AP story, like the Associated Press. So they basically didn't put so the biggest science story in like however long, they didn't either have the time or money or priority to put one of their reporters on covering this. And so I made me realize that, you know, how we're, the LA Times and other print media are, you know, falling short, you know, in part because the revenue model is old. But
I think they don't even have, I bet, do they even have a science reporters anymore? Do they have science reporters?
Yeah. No, I mean, I even follow some of their science reporters on Twitter. I think the science reporting in the local has really picked up for our local public radio channels, or at least KPCC. You know, they've really amped up their science reporting in a serious way. And actually the print journalism on their website's pretty solid. So no, the LA Times does have good science reporters, but they were put on other stories. I think they maybe have been directed to cover more local stuff and not focus on big international things.
Yeah, you can see why, right? I mean,
yeah.
It's, I don't see, if future of science reporting, especially in local newspapers, doing very well. I mean, it's by definition, you know, science isn't local.
Well, as an ecologist, I'm going to have to disagree with you on that. You know, because there's a lot of environmental science issues. You know, if you're dealing with, like, you know, traffic, you know, pollution, you know, but also right. a lot of international big news carries out differently locally. So, for instance, the reporting about the El Nino that's happening this year is going to be really different in Southern California than other places, because we're probably going to get a ton of rain, way more than, say, anywhere else. And so that huge amount. And so the reporter, international reporting, is going to be like, well, it might be getting a lot of rain in L.A. Meanwhile, in L.A., we really need to think about and prepare for that in a different way. I mean, there's, you know, it could be very, very expensive, and people losing property and lives and flooding. And, you know, it's not going to be good. And that's science reporting. And hopefully the L.A. Times is more on that.
That reminds me, I was at Laguna Beach. Have you seen some of those houses there? They're right on the shore, right on the cliffs. It's... I don't know if you've ever gone down there, but this sure this is true.
It's been quite a while, but I mean Malibu is the same way.
Yeah, it's true all over Southern California. But boy, I mean, they look right ready to tip right over. I know, like, some of the foundations go deep and all that, but still, boy, they look precarious sitting out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how you can have such a narrow sliver of land and yet still build a big house on it.
Like, but the houses, some of them are they look like they're actually like. Tipping over. I mean, they're off the edge of the cliff, right? So, like, part of the house is actually off the cliff. It's just kind of suspended, like Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah. Well. So several years ago, there was a flooding event in San Diego on the hill where my mother-in-law lives, and actually, you know, houses got. Basically fell off the mountain and destroyed. I don't think anyone was killed, but they basically had to rebuild a road, and there are some places where there used to be houses where there aren't, up on Mount Soledad. It actually had to do with a broken water main, and so it was like bad maintenance from the city, essentially, is what people have argued. But I mean, but also they were building a house in a place where, you have one big rush of water, and then,
So, I mean, I think if you look at, you know, science coverage in the big newspapers, there are still, you know, some good stuff happening, right? And it's certainly great science writers still out there, but it's getting uglier and uglier. I mean, I think there's a lot of, you know, if you read the blogosphere, there's a lot of criticism of science reporting, obviously, but I mean. There still are good science writers. It's just their lives are pretty tough right now, I think.
Well, I think that we're in this point where print media's funding model has fallen apart. And so now we have this, you know, open scramble for opportunities. And so now there is more serious science reporting in BuzzFeed than in some major newspapers, right? And so clearly that's going to be a more major outfit in the coming years. Yeah. Which you couldn't really imagine before.
That's a little scary, though.
Well, but I mean, but if they're doing the serious reporting, I mean, they're basically, you know, they started out with a, you know, they've grown wisely, essentially. They know how to get the clicks, but at the same time, they're also providing some serious reporting. So the article that they had about this human fossil was a really, really good piece.
BuzzFeed?
The BuzzFeed article about the new human species, someone at Leti, is like, actually, it's a really good article.
But I would still say, I mean, do they have a budget? I mean, I would still say that, you know, if you can afford to send a reporter out there, you know, and they're actually in the area and they're interviewing the scientists, it's a different kind of a story.
Yeah, no, but they're and they hired real writers. And so they hired, I think the head of the section is Virginia Hughes, but then they hired other science writers, like experienced people who've been writing. And so they realize, this is actually a real paying job. Like it's genuinely journalism. You wouldn't think BuzzFeed has journalism, but it does.
But are they putting their resources behind it? I mean, are they sending people out? Are they?
Yeah. I mean, I don't read over there too much because I just find a lot of it annoying, but apparently they've invested. I don't know how much journalism how much journalism is versus journalism or whatever. But yeah. But I'm sure in the coming years that their science reporting is going to be probably better than what I'd be seeing in my local paper.
Yeah, it's a bit sad, but that's the future, I guess.
Yeah. So what's next?
So I think we can jump to what people say when you're a scientist.
Oh,
that's an interesting topic.
Right? Yeah. So when you're at a social occasion, right, you're meeting some people back at home. They don't know you or what you're doing. It's just a thing related to school, your kids, your spouse, whatever. People say, oh, there's that thing where they're like, oh, so what do you do? So what do you say?
I tell them I'm a college professor in biology.
All right. They go, oh, okay. So you say, okay, I'm a biology college professor. Then what do they say? I'm curious. Like, what's the response?
They go, oh, nice. And they tune out. Basically. Or they go, well, I get the, can you teach my kid chemistry kind of request? Yeah. I get that once in a while.
Like, oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
can you tutor my kids?
Oh, no, what I get is, oh, I took biology in college, or I took biology in high school. That was really hard.
Yeah,
like, you ever get that?
Yeah, I get that sometimes.
Yeah.
But no, I get the, can you tutor my kids? And I was like, yeah, I spend, you know, day and night teaching. I want to go home and teach some more. But anyway.
Yeah. You should tell them your hourly rate.
Yeah. But, yeah. Do you get a lot of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I get a whole, the trajectory of the conversation is really predictable based on what I initially say. And I'm not sure what to say. And so because I'm a science, I mean, I'm an ecologist and I work with insects and I work in rainforests. And so I could say I'm a tropical biologist, or I could say I'm an entomologist, or I could say I'm an ecologist. And everyone has a different kind of rote response to that. Or I could just say I'm a scientist or I'm a professor. But the problem is whatever people say, it's frustrating because it really derails the conversation, where it all of a sudden becomes me focused and people feel like they need to respond to some fact that I revealed, or, you know, or I think people have insecurities about not understanding enough science. And so when I say I'm a scientist, then they, you know, reflexively then feel awkward about it, in which I don't want to be that way.
I think people are, they want to ask like intelligent questions, and they feel sort of, you know, they feel the pressure of not knowing anything about insects, or, you know, they don't want to come across as being stupid or ignorant about science.
Yeah.
You know, do you feel that?
There's that.
They feel obligated to ask a question. They want to ask you questions about, you know, your job or about science in general, but they're a little reluctant to.
Yeah, so if it's in my neighborhood, since I live in Pasadena, then that sometimes plays out a little differently, because not that far from me is the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and which is where, you know, they, you know, it's run by NASA, or it's contracted by NASA, and so they, you know, send stuff into outer space, and it's full of rocket scientists. So the, you know, like, actually, I am a rocket scientist, you know, are people's bumper stickers and stuff like that. Or like another bumper sticker, you know, in the parking lot is, my other car is a rover on Mars, or, you know. Or sometimes what I get is, oh, you're a professor, you're a scientist, oh, you must work at Caltech. And I go, no, actually, I'm at Cal State Dominguez Hills. And they're like, oh. And they're like less excited because I don't work at Caltech or something. And that's kind of an awkward thing to deal with, that knockdown and their perceived status, like, oh, he's a scientist, but he doesn't work at Caltech, so he's probably not as good. And so, like, that's a whole layer of awkwardness that I just prefer not to deal with either.
So what do you do?
I don't know. I mean, there is this wine tastingy thing last year, and I had the best time ever. And that's because no one ever asked me what I did. And when I talked to people, they were answering my questions about themselves. And it was a fun conversation. I mean, people asked me about me and my kid, and, you know, how my kid was doing, where he went to school. You know, we talked about soccer and stuff, but what I did for a living never, ever came up, and it was wonderful. And I loved it.
That's great. But sometimes I feel like I'm in a group where you don't ask, like, it's the question that's on everyone's mind. Like, you're a bunch of strangers. Everybody kind of wants to know what everybody else does. but nobody wants to be the first to bring it up. Like, it's the question you don't ask, and it just becomes awkward.
And so, because if you don't, because basically by asking someone what they do for a living, that's sort of, it's a rude question because you're kind of asking how much money do you make, how fancy your house is, stuff like that.
I guess, or just the status of the job, I guess, or maybe then people would perceive you as being there for your own personal benefit. Do you know what I mean? Maybe you're there to make connections. You're there to network. You know, they don't want to give that vibe.
Yeah, yeah, because if you start talking about, yeah, and then it sounds like you're being opportunist.
Exactly.
And so I realize
if you're at a kid's function, the last thing you want to do is come across as being opportunist, right? Obviously, it's a kid's function, you know. So you don't want to do that, so you avoid that question, but you avoid it to such an extent that it becomes awkward.
Yeah, and we spend a lot of time doing what we do, and I think especially us, that, I mean, it's really part of our identity. And so if you're really getting to know a person, how can you get to know me without talking about science with me, about, like, talking about ants and rainforests? And because that's part of what I do. I mean, there's lots of other things I'm into, but, you know, it's like if you avoid that, then you're avoiding intimacy.
Right. But I think also, like, because you're at a wine tasting event, that's – the focus is on – tasting wines, right? It's probably not as unnatural to not talk about it. But whereas if you're just a bunch of parents hanging out, you know, while your kids play, there's no real focus to why you're there, right?
Yeah. Well, no, but I mean, if you're a wine tasting, you're talking about the wine. That's like being at the playground and talking about the weather or something like that.
I guess maybe.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, so here's a funny related story. So several years ago, I was at the podiatrist for something. Didn't even care about why I'm at the podiatrist, really. But he was like, at one point, he was digging into my toe doing this one thing. And he's like asking, oh, so what do you do? Or so on. Because we think I asked him a question that sounded biological enough. He's like, oh, you're a scientist? I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah. It's like, well, I used to teach this human anatomy lab, but I work on ants. And he's like, oh, you work on ants? That must mean you're an entomologist. He's like, ha, ha, ha. And he's like, oh, I bet you hear that one all the time, an entomologist. And so, and I'm like, no, I've never, ever heard that. He's like, oh, you're joking. I'm like, no, no one's ever made that pun. That's not a one that people do. Because you have to know that a person is an entomologist to make the pun that they're an entomologist. And he's like, wow, that's funny. That's the first thing that came to my mind. Because I did take entomology in college. I thought it was fun, you know. And so he's like, well, what do you call – is there a name for people who work on insects for reals? And I'm like, yeah, it's called a – myrmecologist. He's like, oh, that's good to know. And he's like, well, what do people usually say when they find out that you work on ants? And it's like, oh, I'd say probably like about more than half the time people just say, oh, could you tell me how to kill off the ants in my kitchen? Like, what do I do? Could you? No. What they say is, if you study ants, you should come to my house. I got plenty of ants in my house. And people think they're the most witty when they say that, but that's what most people say. You study ants? You should come to my house. You don't have to go to the rainforest. And so I was telling him this. And so I went back for my return visit where they removed whatever they were digging into my toe for. And he was so apparently he had an intern that was working with him. You know, he had his MD. He's like, he's in his residency internship or whatnot. And so he winked at me and then told the intern, hey, so he works on ants in the rainforest. Isn't that interesting? And then the intern said, he work on ants in the rainforest? Huh, you should come to my house. I got more ants there. And he was like, and the podiatrist was like, yeah, yeah, you're right.
Did the podiatrist remember what he had said? Or was he laughing with you?
Yeah, totally. But he was just like, wow, people really are that predictable. And so, I mean, but then again, that's how you connect with it. And so frankly, you know, when I'm not working with my data or my rainforest ants, I'm dealing with the ones that are in my house. And I'm thankful that they haven't come into the kitchen for the last 4 or 5 days. So, yeah.
I wonder what they asked the plant biologist.
Oh, I don't know. I'll have to ask our botanist.
I think at some point the conversation goes to, you know, weed.
Oh, yeah, that weed. Well, I mean, so I would naturally go to food, but then I'm a scientist. I think a lot of people don't think of plants as food. People don't think of their food as food.
No, when they think of plants, they see things growing in the garden.
And yeah.
What's a nice thing to grow in the garden, I guess?
Weed.
I don't know. I don't know. We should ask our plant biologist what questions she gets most.
Yeah, because she probably says that she's a botanist.
That's what she says.
Like, what do you do? I would bet. I don't know. We'll ask her.
But isn't she more... Okay. Well, okay.
I mean, or an evolutionary biologist.
Yes. Yes.
But, well, it depends on if you want, if you say you're an evolutionary biologist, that means you're having that conversation.
Yeah.
Right. And so if in a social occasion, are you going to, you know, and so actually I do this with members of certain family members on this other side of my family, which is, and they say, what do you teach? I'm like, oh, I teach biostatistics and evolution. Now, I don't teach an evolution course, but of course I teach biology, which means I teach evolution. But I'm going to use the E word because I just want to say that's where I am.
What, you just want to pick a fight?
Well, no, it's more like I don't even want to go there with you because I don't want that fight to happen. And so I just want to let them know so that they don't inadvertently say something in the future which is ignorant about biology and science and life, you know.
Is there any other field in science that has that, you know, the moment you mention it, you should be ready for that fight in any kind of social context?
Well, there's... If you work on GMOs and plant breeding,
or you know, global climate issues,
right? Yeah, climate science,
climate science. I guess those are the two big ones.
Yeah, I would say those are probably the big problematic ones. Where,
interesting.
Yeah, I did have this awesome keep mentioning all my medical appointments, but I was at the dentist yesterday and the dental technician was like, oh, because it's been like really unseasonably hot here in LA. And she's like, oh, are you concerned like this really hot weather might end up like causing an earthquake? And I was like, no, like, I don't think so. Not really. It's like, if anything, it just means that, you know, it's global warming. That's what we should expect. And so we talked about it for a couple of weeks. Like, oh, really? So what should we be doing about global warming? And I spent a little bit. It's like, well, you know, we're emitting carbon. And so that's, you know, because, you know, it's like, you know, just, you know, energy sources from driving cars and powering our houses. And so, like, seriously, after about 2 minutes, she was like, oh, so that means like Al Gore was right the whole time. And I'm like,
what?
And I'm like, yeah, that's, yeah.
Where is she from?
I believe she's from Eastern Europe.
Oh. No, but what part of the city were you in?
Oh, it was in Pasadena.
Wow.
But I don't think that she was like, you know, I think she, like most people, was probably mostly apolitical.
Right.
But she was like, oh, Al Gore, blah, 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 wasn't paying much attention. And I was like, yeah, we're burning all this carbon and it's going to the atmosphere and it's making the world warmer. And she didn't really realize that till I mentioned that to her, which is kind of crazy. But she's like, oh, that's why the world's getting hotter. That's not why it's hot today, but that's why things are getting hotter. And like, she's like, oh yeah, well, there's a lot more focus on solar power. I'm like, yeah, exactly. Like, I had that conversation. That was my win for the day, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know if she's going to go buy an electric car now. You know, probably not. Yeah.
No, you know where I live, which is I live down in Irvine, and
that's Orange County.
That's Orange County, by the way. And I was at getting my hair cut, and I was just listening to the people next to me, the guy getting his hair cut and the woman who was cutting the hair, and they were having an Obama conversation. A couple of Orange County people having the Obama conversation in a very muted tones, by the way. I mean, they weren't screaming this stuff, but it was pretty eye-opening. You know, he really is apparently a Muslim Kenyan.
Like, I mean, so they were actually, they really thought he was Muslim.
Yeah, they were convinced. I mean, it wasn't even like, is he a Muslim? It's like, well, it's just stated as a fact. Of course he is. You know, I mean,
it was just a basis.
It was a factual basis upon which they were having the conversation. He's a Muslim. He's a communist. It's just incredible. I'm just sitting next to these people, and it really is eye-opening.
Wow. I guess if you do the math, there's about 30% of the country that is like that diluted, which those are the 30% that, like, you know, still claim that, you know, Bush was a great president that...
No. Bush is not a great president. Bush was a liberal.
Oh.
Bush was a liberal. That's what I heard from them.
Like, but Bush as George W. Bush.
George W. Bush was liberal. Yeah, he had liberal views. There you go.
So you figure there's a higher density of that in Orange County, but still.
Well, I think it's pretty much, they kind of recognize that his presidency was not exactly successful. And they have to kind of justify that, right?
Oh, that's the rationalization.
Yeah,
that's the rationalization. Is that since it failed, it was because he wasn't conservative enough.
Yes. Well, he wasn't the right kind. He wasn't even a conservative.
Yeah, because he was compassionate. You don't want compassion.
Well, I'm not sure what they were trying to. But yeah, it was depressing. And yet informative.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also the other thing is if I'm at some businessy type occasion, I say I'm a scientist, right? Then that also introduces the fact that I'm probably some raging liberal too. And yeah. So by outing myself as a scientist, then I'm also outing myself with like many other stereotypes that are, you know, that are associated with scientists.
Yes. Stereotypes like belief in rational thought. And proof of evidence and rationalism. God help us.
Yeah.
Stop making sense.
Indeed. Okay, what's next?
So here's an interesting one. Since we've started a podcast, I think one of the really great things that if we can do is to have guests.
Well, you know, people, yeah, clearly it can't be just us all the time.
Right. I really hope that we can have people come on the show and talk about stuff. I think that would be really interesting. I don't want just scientists. I want all kinds of people.
Yeah, indeed.
Anybody who's interesting, I would consider having on, except for people in Hollywood.
Yeah, and if we talk to scientists, I'm not going to want to say, oh, tell me about your last experiment. I want to hear about them as people, I think, actually.
Yes.
Because a lot of scientists are really interesting people.
Right. And interesting, like, as to how their mind works, right? Kind of the way they think about problems.
Very interesting. Yeah.
They're just a lot of interesting people. So who would you like to have on the podcast? Anybody. Don't just restrict yourself to the scientists.
Yeah, yeah. So one thing on my wish list, just because I think... it's mysterious and relatively bizarre, as I'd be interested in finding someone who spent some substantial amount of time visiting in North Korea to find out, well, what the heck is North Korea like? I understand that when you visit, they put on a show for you and they're trying to hide the way things really are. But I mean, to me, it's just got to be an entirely surreal experience. And so it'd be interesting to get that story from someone.
Yes.
So HK is Korean, by the way. So
South Korean. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
you. Far south. And so, who else?
Let's talk about, we could do a whole show on North Korea. You know, there's a guy by the name of Brian Myers, who's an expert he's an expert on, if you can believe, on North Korean literature. It's a literature. It's a canon of work based on, you know, one subject. But he would definitely be an interesting person to have on, with a very interesting perspective on things.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, so.
He's a guy. He's American. I think he's American. Mm-hmm. He's American. He's a white guy. So, you know, I don't want to conflate American with white. He's a white, yes. He lives in Korea, in South Korea, and he's a professor of North Korean literature in South Korea. So he teaches North Korean literature to South Korean students.
Wow.
So he's a pretty impressive guy, I think.
Yeah.
And he's got some insights, which are definitely worth them. He wrote a book called The Cleanest Race. Which is definitely worth reading.
Yeah, I'd be into that.
And I think the reason why the book is, he gets it right, I think, it's they do see themselves as a race, it's not a national identity or an ethnicity, it's a race. But the interesting thing is, when you read that book as a South Korean person, you recognize certain qualities that are just Korean. And it's a little scary. Like how, you know, South Korea sees itself as this very advanced, technologically advanced, you know, country, you know, well-educated, whatever. And yet there are these common features, characteristics that you see in the North.
Yeah, because basically, like thinking about this in terms of evolutionary biology, basically you've had this, you know, a single cultural, I mean, with, you know, specializations and groups or whatnot, but then you just have this barrier that's been put up, and then you've had basically independent evolution since then. Yes. And so, I mean, there's different words, different concepts. So probably some things that happen in the North would seem outmoded to a South Korean, and vice versa. Probably South Koreans might do some things that North Koreans, you know, think, oh, that's the way things used to be, and they don't do it anymore.
Well, the language per se, for example, has bifurcated, right? So it's very difficult to understand what they're saying. I can kind of understand it, but they use a lot of words that obviously don't mean the same thing. And also the North Koreans have a hard time understanding South Koreans because South Koreans, the language is just peppered with English words now.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So they don't understand. It's very interesting because even South Korean experts on North Korea often have trouble trying to figure out what they're actually trying to say.
Wow.
Yeah, because it's difficult because it's an isolated country, right? You don't have the sort of migration of, you know, language. So
yeah, and if there's new technologies and new ideas, then probably entirely different words have been introduced for them.
Right.
Maybe.
Well, I don't think that's happening in North Korea, but in North Korea, I mean, the language is changing, yeah. And there's no way to access that those changes, right? So one of the interesting things is that there are certain people in D.C. who call themselves North Korea experts. Who don't speak Korean of any kind. It's very bizarre.
That is weird. I mean...
but, I mean, they don't speak Korean the way South Koreans speak it, which is sort of, seems to be the minimum.
Yeah.
They certainly don't speak it the way the North Koreans speak it. They don't speak any Korean. And yet, they are at these think tanks for dictating policy. It's very bizarre. By the way, there are real experts in Washington. I think most of them are in the CIA, by the way. But yeah. there are real North Korea experts. But then there's a cottage industry of these people. You see them on C-SPAN a lot, who call themselves experts, but who don't speak a word of Korean, who can't read Korean. It's very weird. I mean, if you had somebody who called themselves an expert on Italian politics, and you discovered they don't speak Italian. I mean, what would you think? You would think, yeah, it's contradiction. But there you are.
Wow. Okay, so another person that I would be interested in having on the show would be, there's this woman named Kelsey Ryder, who's a PhD student at Florida International University, and she just does some really interesting field work. So her dissertation, she's working on these frogs, these tadpoles that are living in melted glaciers up in the Andes. So she basically, you know, backpacks and llamas out to the middle of nowhere. I've just seen her pictures on Facebook and whatnot. And is for months at a time living in a really remote, super duper high elevation area, you know, studying these frogs that apparently I believe have been there for a long while. But, you know, then as glaciers are melting more, then you're basically having more glacier melt. But then when the glaciers are gone, then what's happening to the frogs? And so, I don't know what her question is, but it sounds like an amazing project and some cool work associated with it.
So she's roughing it in the Andes, wherever she is?
Yeah, yeah. So she's, you know, eating guinea pig and whatnot in the middle of nowhere.
So she's living in a tent or something?
I believe she's been living in tents for months at a time up there in the Andes, yeah.
Wow.
So.
I bet she's glad when her PhD is done.
Yeah, well, she'll probably miss it too. But I mean, she chose a seriously ambitious project.
Wow.
Because I know her from the work in my field station in Costa Rica, where she also did a huge project, something else. But yeah, but she knows her frogs and she's a cool, adventurous person. So it'd be interesting to hear about her times up there and what she's been up to.
Does she have a blog?
You know, she has a blog and I've linked to it, but she hasn't like posted super duper often, but there are some photos. And so. I think it was more of a blog just so she can just communicate with friends and family so they know that she's up to, that she's not like not dead in the middle of nowhere or whatever.
I guess hard to get internet access up there. So she probably couldn't update it even, you know, if she wanted to.
Yeah, that's true. And so I don't know. Yeah, I think she, whenever she hit the closest town or whatever.
Yeah, well, you'd think that, I mean, she would be a, she's a person who should have a blog.
Yeah, she should. A lot of people should have a blog because they'd have a lot of interesting stuff to say.
That's true.
Who else would be on your list?
The one person I talked about, I would be interested on having would be, well, there are a lot of people. Dan Grauer. Grauer?
Mm.
Grauer?
Yeah. Grauer. I don't know.
Grauer, I think it is.
Okay.
Because
University of Houston?
University of Houston. Yeah. He's not out to make friends.
Yeah.
He wrote a really tough paper criticizing the ENCODE consortium.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it's a paper, both the tone and the angle at which it's written is rare in a scientific paper.
Because it was just didn't pull punches.
It didn't pull punches.
So why don't you tell it, what's ENCODE? Why don't you, cause actually, I'm vaguely aware of what it is, but...
It's a very, it's what you would call big science, right? So it's lots of people studying, trying to categorize the functional units of the genome. So we have the genome sequence, which is the letter by letter, you know, alphabet
yeah.
of the human genome.
But we don't know what it does.
Well, we know what a lot of it does, and a lot of it does nothing. But now they're trying to actually map out discrete units and what those units do. So it's a slightly larger scale analysis of the genome, which is fine, right? There's nothing wrong with that, and they spend quite a bit of money. But they're making claims which are quite extraordinary, and they're getting challenged. And the way they're doing it is a little weird, right? So instead of the straightforward kind of peer review, they kind of managed to do it seemed more like a PR campaign. They published a lot of papers at once in a lot of journals. They seem to have done a deal with, and I can't remember if it's Science or Nature, but one of the two, to publish papers without peer review. Right, so they did kind of a...
That's not good.
No. Anyway, but their central claim is that... now they're backtracked a little bit, so it depends who you ask, but something like 80% of the genome is functional, is what they're arguing.
Which is contrary to what we've always been hearing.
Yes, for a long time.
So functional meaning that it creates protein that does stuff?
No. Well, that's another problem. What does it mean to be functional, right?
Right. It's like, are you regulating something else in some way or, yeah.
Well, yes. I think eventually it comes down to functional is whatever we say functional is. But anyway, so yeah. That's another argument you can have. Like, what is junk? Because, you know, for a long time, people thought the vast majority of the human genome was junk, right? Well, what is junk?
But then if you get rid of it, is everything exactly the same? And if let's say you just deleted a huge section that people called junk, well, then would you find any difference in any functioning at all?
Right.
Probably, right?
Yes. Well, you know what? We should have Dan Grauer come over and tell us all about this.
Yeah,
at one level, they are defining function as whatever piece of DNA that a protein binds to, right? Which is a ridiculous definition because... You know, DNA polymerase binds to every...
Yeah, it's like if you're copying it.
So it's stupid. It's a stupid... they obviously didn't think about that. But so that's obviously a problematic. Even the problem is that even if a piece of DNA gets transcribed, right? So even if you make a piece of RNA from DNA, you can't necessarily assume that that is a functional piece of DNA because there's spurious... transcription happening all the time. You got little bits of erroneous transcription happening all over the genome. right? It does not necessarily mean that that's actually a meaningful RNA that's getting made, right? So you always get these low baseline levels of transcription happening all over the genome that actually don't ever code for anything. It doesn't code for, certainly doesn't code for an mRNA, or, you know, it doesn't code for a protein, doesn't even code for anything else. So anyway.
Oh, which is connected to someone else that occurs to me that would be great to have on. So I went to this geochemistry meeting last summer.
Yes.
In which I know very little geology and I'm not a chemist. And so, but I talked about ants and stable isotopes and nutrients across landscapes. Anyway, and so what I went to this talk by a guy who I know from social media, and it totally blew me away. And there's all of these people who work in oceans that study the pieces of DNA that are free floating, this extracellular RNA and DNA in the environment. And so if you were just to grab some ocean water and run, you know, piece and sequence it out, even though there might be no organisms at all, although clearly there are, but outside the organisms, you can actually filter the organisms out, and there's still just DNA floating in the environment. Hmm. And there's a lot that can be learned about organismal processes, and you can make inferences about what microbes are doing, what processes, and how much photosynthesis is happening, and all these other things just by studying free-floating genes
in the water. So this is just debris.
Yeah, it's debris, it's leftover, presumably, or maybe it does have some function targeting some other organism. And I mean, some of it probably is actually for communication between, you know, organisms that are not connected to one another. Let's say, like, you know, because for instance, like organisms that would time things simultaneously.
Yeah, you probably wouldn't see a lot of RNA, I would think.
Probably, no, yeah. When
it's,
I'm saying,
it's too unstable.
Yeah, it is. I mean, unless there are some RNAs which have, you know, been selected for surviving in some way. I don't know. So anyway, but so there are these people that work on that.
So Dan Groh is an interesting guy. He's not shy about expressing his opinions, and I think he'd be definitely worth having on. Very exciting if he would ever come on. The other guy I was thinking was... another person I like to read online is Derek Lowe. He's a scientist. He's an organic chemist who works in the drug industry. He's in big pharma, essentially, I think.
Hmm.
And he's got interesting things to say about the pharmaceutical industry. Very interesting guy.
But he works in the industry.
He's in the biz, as it were. But, you know, he talks about how it's a tough business. You know, it's a difficult business. It sort of is – the business model seems to be rather like Hollywood, right? It's boom or bust. It's like, you know, everyone's looking for the blockbuster. Yeah, he's got lots of interesting things to say. So he's got a really interesting blog, which we should put in the show notes.
Yeah. So another person that I'd be interested in talking to, there's a couple people who work up at Deep Springs College. And so a lot of people haven't heard of this place. But for among people who have heard of it, they're like, oh, that's an amazing, prestigious place. It's this small working ranch, which is a two-year college just north of Death Valley National Park. And it's been in existence for over 100 years. And so most people that go there end up transferring to Stanford or some Ivy or whatever. But basically you're working on the ranch along with 26 other men. It's a men's school, but they're soon going to be accepting women. And it's just an amazing, you know, intellectually engaging place. But, you know, they're also, you know, working as bakers and cowboys and farming alfalfa and, you know, doing the work on the ranch.
So they don't – it's not a degree granting institution.
You know, I don't know. You know, I visited there for a couple days, and we didn't talk about that because basically, pretty much almost everyone there transfers to a 4-year college, and you basically get about a year and a half's worth of credit when you transfer. But some people actually, I think, have already college degrees and they go there and they're just going there for the experience. Like it was created with the notion of creating future captains of industry, although that's not what happens with everybody. But I think a lot of people end up being strong leaders. It's also really competitive to get in, of course.
So what's the class size? like entering cohort?
I think it's 13 people per cohort, you know, and there's hundreds of applications. And the admissions committee is some faculty, but mostly students.
Yeah.
So it would be interesting to find out how the place works, what the philosophy is, what people do. Apparently, most of the students kind of go feral when they're there, like, you know, stop showering, sleep up in the mountains and, you know, but the coursework is innovative and engaging and, you know, all hands on and stuff.
I do wonder, though, with a, you know, if you have a college that's that selective, I mean, are you just selecting high? Are you just selecting high performance students in the first place? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and so actually, and that's part of a discussion of the admissions people. Like, and so I mean, so they take people. I think you have to be academically strong. I think you need, like, you're not. They're not going to take someone who doesn't academically have it. But also,
but what's their value add? Is what I'm asking, I guess. Do you know what I mean?
So when you graduate, how are you different?
Yeah, when you leave that place, like what are they bringing?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think, well, I mean, the idea is if you're already amazing and you get accepted, then how are you more amazing?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, I mean, if people come in as raw, they appreciate the value of hard work and know how hard non-academic work is. And seeing how you integrate academic work with just daily life and, I don't know. I mean, that's a question to ask in the interview, wouldn't it be?
It seems like it's a unique experience. Obviously, it's like it's an undergraduate experience, like you would not get anywhere else. Clearly,
yeah.
And clearly, people want it.
Yeah. So, but I mean, even having visited for a couple days, I'm just really curious about how they work, what they do, what their philosophy is, what happens to people when they graduate. What is the motivation of people when they go? I mean, I actually heard about it when I was in high school and I didn't bother applying because I thought, well, I wouldn't get in is what I thought. Maybe I don't know if I could. But they also keep really rough hours. Like, the, you know, the guy who milks the cows gets up at 3 or 4 a.m. I couldn't do that. But the milk is really good.
Is it raw?
It is raw. They have a little legally mandated sign next to it. But it was like the, you know, I mean, I had a little glass of the milk. It was like, oh, I mean, part of it is that it's just full fat milk, which people aren't used to nowadays. But just like, just put a little bit of that in your coffee. It was like 5 times better than just adding normal cream. It's like, oh, like it's amazing.
So I had never heard of this place. Like, it's been around a while, though.
It's been around for, I think just 100 years. I just bought a book written by a former president about the history of the school, but I haven't read it yet.
I'll be interested to see what their financial model is. Usually a place like this would either grow or they'll go bust, right? You'd think.
Right. And they basically, the farm apparently doesn't pay for itself. So they have an endowment.
Okay.
And now that actually a bunch of their alums ended up being successful, and I think that's part of the continued success. But they are getting by just fine, apparently. But I mean, it's also a small place. They basically lease out land to do, you know, ranching and farming in the Deep Springs Valley. They own some of it, and some of it's BLM land, Bureau of Land Management land, which they ranch on.
So okay, so the student body is like 20 something, 30, right? 20, 30.
Yeah, I think some are fresh from high school. Some are a little older. I'm not sure. I think there might be one or two in their 30s, but yeah, they're early 20s, I think.
Okay. No, but the number of students.
I think they shoot for having a total of 26. They basically take 13 new ones a year.
Okay. 26 all male. Wow.
Yeah, but that's changing. But yeah, Deep Springs College.
And how many faculty?
I think it's 4 or 5. They basically have a dean, and then they have a person who is the chair of natural sciences, and a person who's chair of the humanities, and then they have other people come for a semester or a year or two at a time. So a friend of mine is the chair of the natural sciences, and so she's teaching, you know, biology and chemistry and you know, vertebrate biology. You know, she also, you know, but she also, like, you know, makes her own instruments and, you know, and also does art. So probably end up teaching painting and whatnot.
So they have formal classes or?
Yeah, so they have formal classes and they have a classroom. And actually their library is really impressive for the size of the place. And as a student, you choose to take as many classes as you want. So the faculty members propose a list of classes that they are interested in teaching. And then the students vote and then choose a couple of those. And then the faculty then teach them. And so, but I've seen, like, you know, the exams that they're taking, and they're really academically rigorous. Like, so for instance, there's this class on the chemistry of food. But then when I looked at what she's teaching about the chemistry of food, it's like, oh man, like, they're learning substantial, like, organic chemistry and biological processes in a major way. But it's in the context of food chemistry. That's really interesting. So it's interesting is because there are these innovative, unique one-off classes that they, when you transfer, it's hard for some of those courses to transfer, but I don't think that really influences so much what courses they offer.
I wonder if they read that book. You know that book, On Food and Wine?
On Food and Wine? Is that what it's called?
Oh.
No.
What is it called? I should look that up. I have it somewhere. It's a really good book on sort of the science of food and wine.
Hmm.
You know what I'm talking about? You don't know what I'm talking about?
No, I do not.
It's not Alton Brown, I tell you that.
Okay. I mean, it's a lot more technical and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's a Caltech guy, actually. Harold McGee. On food and cooking, sorry.
I'm drawing a blank.
Harold McGee on food and cooking. The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. Really good book. It's not a recipe book. It's a book about the chemistry of food. Chemistry and biology of food. And for example, like if you add salt during cooking, versus adding salt after cooking, so the temperature of the food is going to affect what's going to happen to the salt, and that's going to affect the taste.
Almost all recipes tell you to add the salt at the end, and that's because, and actually it will taste different than if you add it during.
Right, so because you're not going to melt the salt granules, right? So it'll give you a sharper, saltier taste. And if you add it during, it'll give you more of a blended taste, right? Because it's the salt crystals are melted and dispersed.
Oh, okay.
Things like that, tricks.
So, which is explained, like if you have like a can of tomatoes or a can of beans or whatever, or canned soup, it's like supremely salty. But when you eat it, it doesn't taste insanely salty.
Huh.
For example, yeah. Like, I don't know if there's people are just inured to salt, but if you look at some things, like if I were just to, like, let's say I were to make like split pea soup at home on my own,
right,
and add salt in it at the end, I'm like, oh, okay, and it's like salted as I want. But then I would open a can of split pea soup and then eat it, and it's like, it tastes roughly the same salty. But then you look at the sodium, and it's like a ton of salt that was put into it when I was cooking, way more than when I added myself.
So you added it at the end, did you?
Well, no,
you
don't add it. Well, if I were to make my own, like pop it in the pressure cooker and all that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe they add other stuff that sort of disguises the, I don't know.
That this increases the sodium. Well, but I mean, in general, like, you know, these, you know, prepared, you know, foods, you know, processed foods have way more salt in them than not, for whatever reason. Like, I don't know if in the food engineering process, why that is.
One thing I noticed also, like when I, like if I go to Korea for like a month, I basically don't eat American food for a month, Western food. And I come back and to the States and I start eating, you know, burgers and other things.
Mm-hmm.
It just tastes a lot saltier. But you notice the taste, the salt.
So we're just inured to the salt here, then.
I don't know. I don't know if it's. I don't know. I don't know what's going on. All I know is that it just. You notice the salt much more. The Harold McGee book is really good. I would recommend anybody buy that book.
That's good to know. Hey, okay, now I'm looking at the clock and I do have to get rolling.
All right, so this was episode one. We'll do it again.
That's right. Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Adios.